That was the end of the interview with Moriyama on 19 August 79, and this is now beginning with Vic Hughes at Montreal, also on August 19th, 1979. Now, can you please tell me what your undergraduate training was, and then how you first came into contact with radio or radar astronomy?
Yeah, the interests in the... My early interests in school were in radio, in fact. I was always interested in building radio sets. And we also had an astronomy club, so I had some basic interest in both, both aspects. And I felt that I'd like to go into electronics, and so for this reason, one went to the University of Manchester, but to the Faculty of Technology, for a degree in light current electrical engineering, which really covered electronics, and also applied physics, electromagnetic theory, etc. So it's equivalent to what actually what we call here an engineering physics degree.
Light current meant it wasn't the heavy.
It wasn't power heavy power transmission of machines and all that sort of thing.
That's what we call electronics nowadays.
That's right. Yeah. But one had to know a little bit about that in an elementary way. And also in the applied physics, we took a fair bit of ionosphere work because the head of the electrical engineering department there was a man who'd done a fair bit of work in the early days of the ionosphere, but whereas he was doing experiments to detect the ionosphere rather than changing frequency at a single place, he was doing experiments measuring out at distances, measuring the decay and intensity of the signal as you moved out in distance from a point, from a place. This must have been the early 30s when he did.
And who is he?
Oh, if you stop him for a minute, I'll try. Okay, so anyway, I started in 1942, actually, and wartime was on, so that in those days, instead of having three terms a year, they put an extra term in the summer and we had four.
Right.
And whereas in the UK, one's better prepared when one goes to university, and the university used to run for 3 years instead of four here. So that the whole degree was finished in 2 years, 3 months. So that,
right.
So that by December of 1944, I came out with an honours degree, still at the age of 19, apparently, I think. So, graduation was in the early 1945, and then in 45, I think it was about February, I was directed into the telecommunications research establishment to work on radar. And the war finished off not long after that. I think the war landing in Europe had already come about. And when the war finished, then in fact all those scientists who had gone into radar were essentially released. Those
right.
who had been in the shortest time went first.
Right.
And at that time, amongst other things, I applied for the Scientific Civil Service. But also it was mentioned to me that Lovell had gone back to Manchester to work on trying to detect the energy of primary cosmic ray particles using
right.
radar techniques. He and Blackett had written this paper in the air raid shelter in London, and they got an error. You know the error came. So I wrote to Lovell, and Lovell said yes. He was just reorganizing things though, and he let me know in due course. And so actually, for a few months I worked at the post office research station at Dulles Hill in measuring the frequencies in speech or the amplitude in speech as a forerunner to switching and modern telephone. Anyway. I then wrote back to Lovell, and it didn't seem to be the thing I wanted. I wrote back to Lovell, and he said, yes, okay, come and join us. Or rather, I went up to see him that summer, and they had been at Manchester. You know the story at Manchester where they tried to detect cosmic rays in the university?
In the city, right.
And the streetcars going by.
Right.
And so they moved out to the Jodrell Bank experimental grounds of the botany department
right.
for an experimental period of 6 months to do some experiments. Well... When I went out there, I remember going with Lovell and seeing the radar chip and a terrific echo coming. And Lovell was saying, well, they're probably not cosmic rays. I think at that time he probably said they were meteors, or I thought there was something else. But then there was the great shower that in fact confirmed that they were meteors. And I went into Jodrell Bank in December of 46.
Right. So it was the summer of 46 when you first visited.
It was the summer of 46 when I first visited. And I went there in December 46, and by this time we were working on meteors.
Now, were you joining as a staff member or as a graduate student?
No, as a graduate student.
Right.
And
so what struck you about this group when you joined up with them?
Well, there were only about two or three other people at the time. So there's Clegg, Lovell. There's another guy who started to do some moon echo, Frank Moran. who started to do some early moon echo work or building an equipment for that. There was Ian Gatenby, I think, or he came later. There's another chap who went back to Glasgow, Douglas Forsyth, I think his name was, who went back to Glasgow to do law because his family was in law. He was going to see him went back. And, I've forgotten, there might have been someone else. There was someone else who, there was an Australian who kept turning up every now and again, but didn't, then disappeared. He kind of working there, but only, But the real thing about it was we were so enthusiastic, I think. I mean, there were reports in the newspaper of what was going on at Jodrell Bank, and it used to be saying we were picked graduate students and graduate students with picks. I mean, I learned to mix concrete and you know, put up antennas, and when not long ago I was doing some plumbing at home, and the kids came in and saw me soldering up pipes. They said, you know, was your father a plumber? I suddenly realized that I'd learnt my plumbing soldering up antennae at Jodrell Bank. So this terrific amount of enthusiasm, and we spent hours out at Jodrell Bank there. Mm-hmm. It really was. I think it was an aftermath of the pressure that came on, or the excitement of the war, or the, not so much excitement as the necessity to do
the pressure,
something during wartime.
Yeah.
You know, as a matter of survival, this sort of thing went on.
Right. And so this just sort of carried over to...
This carried over to Jodrell Bank.
After the war, yeah.
I think that's what got Jodrell Bank going in the way it did.
Hmm.
It was... the work, I did some initial work with on the meteors, but also I helped to, with Johnny Clegg, to build the first big parabolic telescope, which is a fixed telescope on the ground. I think it was about 120 feet in diameter. I've forgotten now. The focus was on top of a 120-foot tower.
Mm-hmm.
And
was that movable at all?
No, it wasn't movable at the time. Henry Brown took it over later on and started tipping the focus. It was originally planned to, because it might have sufficient collecting area to detect the radar echoes from cosmic rays, or cosmic ray showers. It's an echo from the ionization produced as the cosmic ray particle came into the Earth's atmosphere. Well, that was
so, so this was not the original Blackett and Lovell idea, but...
It was the follow-up to the original...
A modification of it.
No, it was the follow-up to the Blackett and Lovell idea. Their idea was that a cosmic ray particle coming in would produce a cascade stream of electrons, and they could get a radar echo from this.
Right.
But the original idea of this big paraboloid on the ground was to give bigger collecting area so as to get smaller intensity echoes, I guess, from the hence lower energy particle, cosmic ray particle.
So it was the same idea then?
It was the same idea.
Just with greater sensitivity.
Yeah, that's right. But of course, by this time, it was realized that it wasn't the cosmic rays that one was getting an echo from, but at also about this time, the radio astronomy as such, the passive radio astronomy, was coming along. And so it was decided to more or less carry on with this, with building the telescope, and to actually use it to measure the intensity of a narrow strip of sky, and then essentially to change frequency and trying to get the spectrum of this background radiation, which no one really knew much about.
Right. Now, was this a parabola or a sphere?
No, this was a paraboloid that we... it was a paraboloid that we built. It was a paraboloid. That's right. It was a paraboloid.
Yeah, so you couldn't have moved the focus...
You can move the focus to a certain amount, but not all that much.
Not very much, anyway. Well, yeah.
Henry Brown did tip that, and but most of the concentration at Jodrell Bank was on meteors.
Yes, right. But I'm still not quite clear on something. Blackett and Lovell wrote the paper. Then the initial emphasis at Jodrell Bank was to follow that up.
Right.
And was that when this dish was initially planned?
Even before I got there.
And then in the building of it, was the error discovered, or? Or did that dish actually try to do these observations?
I'm not sure. That dish was used to try to detect cosmic rays. In fact, it came back a complete circle. But it was realized that the I'm not sure when that error was detected. I'm not sure.
Hmm.
I know that it things swung right away from cosmic rays when the meteors came along. But when the actual error. I think we knew about the error. We knew about that error. I'm sure we did.
But nevertheless, it was felt the dish would still be useful for passive work.
It worked useful for passive work, but it was also tried out for... It was tight. The transmitter was coupled up to it, I'm pretty sure, and it was attempt to see what one could get from it. I think I'm pretty sure that
on the grounds that you might as well give it a go.
That's right. And those were the days when you tried something.
Well, discoveries were being made every week.
That's right.
So, but nevertheless,
I think I'm right on that. Yeah.
Nevertheless, the main effort was in meteors, certainly, and your thesis and so forth was meteors, I presume.
No,
that's not right.
No, I was given the job of doing this experiment of trying to measure the spectrum of the narrow strip of sky.
Oh, I see.
To get some idea of what the background radiation was due to. It's one of the few things you can do. And the only things I had to go on there were, first of all, we had it set up for 72 megahertz, or megacycles, I guess, as they were then.
Yeah.
The reason for that frequency was it was the frequency of the radar transmitters that were loaned by Hay that we used for the meteor work, and that was the frequency that we used. So, first of all, set it up at 72 megahertz, and I got it working at 72, and sure enough, I measured the variation in radiation. The angular resolution was, Lord knows, it was degrees or something like that.
Sure.
And then one decided to change frequency to somewhere, I think it was somewhere about 160 megahertz. And of course, Reber had done some work on measuring the background radiation.
And precisely about that frequency.
Somewhere about that frequency, right. That's right. And so I went and checked up on his papers and decided that it would be easier, or it would be feasible, to measure the intensity would be so high that one didn't need to go into the complicated Ryle system or the Dickey system radiometer, and that a straight receiver would do. And in addition to this, of course, using a straight receiver, you had a factor of two because you were looking at the source the whole time. But unfortunately, Reber didn't know really how to calibrate his original antenna.
Yes,
I've
looked into that in a lot of detail.
Right. Well, I set up this receiver, and I think I was an order of magnitude out. I think the level of cosmic noise, as we called it then, was about an order of magnitude down on what I'd anticipated from Reber's original work. The result of this was that since we used open wire transmission lines coming down the tower, that whenever it looked like rain, the humidity went up, the impedance changed, and terrific mismatches, and the pen went all over the place. So that it wasn't... I did enough work anyway to put in as for an MSc, and in those days the MSc was being considered as a research degree. It oscillated quite a bit. And then I registered for a one-year PhD for the first year of a PhD. But it was after this that Hay came along and was looking for someone to help him out on radar.
I see.
And I felt that I would get further by working with Hay on radar than staying at Jodrell Bank. So, I didn't bother about a PhD. One had the example of Blackett, who was the head of the department, who got a Nobel Prize, who hadn't bothered about a PhD. Ryle hadn't got a PhD. Radcliffe hadn't.
It wasn't the sort of thing it is today. It wasn't a union card.
It wasn't so much a union. It more depended on what you'd done and what you published rather than on.
And I suppose, especially after the war, that was more true. I mean, people had a tremendous after experience. It was not necessarily academic.
That's right. Well, I suppose Tommy Gold is another one. I think a couple of years ago he got a PhD from
Cambridge. Oh, is that right? I didn't realize that.
But Hoyle still hasn't got.
Hoyle still doesn't have a PhD. I didn't realize it for either of those guys.
Anyway, Israeli, a follow-up with this. Hanbury Brown came at that time, and he finally took him about a couple of years to get that telescope working, and he had to go into a coaxial line because these troubles with impedance were quite serious.
One thing I was surprised by is, didn't you have no problems with interference? I mean, 72 megahertz.
Do you want little stories here?
Yes, anecdotes I love.
The first time I got the antenna coupled up to the receiver, the first night, I left it running overnight. We had on storage batteries, and when I came back, there were a number of fluctuations, and Lovell came in and, as he used to see how things are getting on and kind of say, well, Hughes, how are you going? I said, well, I got some fluctuations. Oh, radio stars, says he. So anyway, I said, I'm not sure yet, I'd better leave it for another night. So the following night, I came along, a lot more fluctuations coming along, and Lovell said, radio stars. So the following day was a Saturday, bring them into the physics lab in Manchester and show them. So. Anyway, the following, that Friday night, I got some more records. On the Saturday morning, I took them took them in, and Lovell was going around saying to everyone, look, look at all these radio stars. I said, yes, look, but they don't correlate in time. No, radio stars. So anyway, I did the obvious thing, and that was to put a pair of headphones onto the output of the receiver. And when the fluctuation started, I heard a voice saying, we'll pick up a lady in a green hat at corner of Huddersfield Road. It was a taxi service in Oldham. And this was one of the problems with that problem.
Right,
the antenna was so high up. So that there was trouble with interference, not only the taxi services. And it was from then on, incidentally, that Lovell started to talk to the post office in the UK, who are responsible for frequency allocations. Mm-hmm. And they started an agreement. They started doing then coming in agreements of keeping certain frequency bands.
I see.
As far as Henry Brown is concerned, by the way, I can put this other point. He took over the work that I was doing there. But when he came in, I can always remember him saying to me, and we're talking about interferometers. And you know, the phase interferometer connecting at RF so as to maintain phase. I remember him saying at the time, why can't you put two different detector peaks and correlate the video output?
Right.
And I can remember at the time kind of saying, a feeling, well, you've lost something, and the problem there is the noise that's coming in from the source is small in comparison with the receiver noise. Obviously, you're throwing away phase.
Yeah.
But it was from then on that he started thinking about this, mm-hmm. and the follow-up with this was the Henry Brown twist interferometer.
I have talked to him at length.
I see.
And also, in the first chapter of his book, you might be interested. Have you ever seen the intensity interferometer?
I haven't.
He outlines his early thoughts on the.
That's right. I know that's come out recently. Yeah. I haven't read it yet, but that was the one he wrote because he got fed up with having to tell people all about
explain go away and read how it works. And, but nevertheless, you had these two papers with Lovell in which you worked on the daytime meteor showers.
That's
so
right.
So it must have been a side project, more or less? Or
well, that was one of the first projects that we worked on. In fact, I discovered those daytime meteor showers, but I don't know whether... Do you want another story on...
I'm always ready for stories. I mean,
okay.
That's what this is for.
That was, we used to share the observing the radar for meteors, and there was one, we knew that there was a meteor shower, I've just forgotten the name, it was the quadrant, it was one of the early summer meteor showers, and we took it in turn observing, and it came to my turn to observe at something like 6 o'clock in the morning or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And in those days, we just had the hut belonging to the botany department with an armchair in front of one of these old pot stoves. And the other hut where we cleared the onions out of and used it as a lab. But one used to kind of could sleep in the old gardener's armchair in front of the stove. And we had a small truck. And I fixed up with Johnny Clegg that he would come along, I'd come in with the truck, he'd take me out to Jodrell Bank, that he would go back into Wilmslow and then come out later on the next day. Well, on the way out, old Johnny Clegg was his way, he said, how about a drink? And so we went and had a few beers, and I went out, and I went to sleep, and I overslept. So when I came to next morning to come and look at the clock, it was about an hour, and the meteor stream should have gone by, and the telescope should have been turned.
Right.
So I went over to the radar, wondering whether to turn the telescope to follow it up, and when I looked at the tube, there was a fantastic echo came in, and then a few more came in. So I just sat down and started logging them, and when Lovell came later and Clegg came later, we just kept on logging and logging, and throughout the day for quite a number of hours, there's this very intense meteor.
Now, was that the first meteor, daytime meteor shower?
That was the start of the so-called daytime meteor streams.
But had there been no discussion that these things must exist and that you should maybe... It would seem to me like that would be an obvious thing to do with the radar meteor. I mean, this is something...
It wasn't known about. I think maybe the real trouble there was that most of the meteor work was done by amateurs. It's the British Astronomical Society and Astronomical Association and the Meteor Observing Section.
Right.
And they were mainly amateurs, which is one reason why there's a big, great dearth of meteor streams around Christmas and New Year. But, so that it was really on observation.
Well, but of course they could not see the daytime. But what I'm saying is that
having this technique, which doesn't depend on day and night, I mean, one knows that there must be meteors coming in the daytime.
Right.
Now here's a chance to study them finally after hundreds of years.
Right.
But you guys apparently didn't take that tack. It came about accidentally, is what
you're saying. No, well, essentially, there was a meteor stream. I'd have to go back, and I've just forgotten this. It's a long time ago. There was a meteor stream that we decided to monitor. It could well have been that we would have looked for those summer meteors later on. And in fact, later on, there was a fixed arrays set up to continuously monitor meteors.
24 hours a day.
24 hours a day.
Yeah.
But in those days, we just had this big set, the searchlight antenna, as we called it, a searchlight with 2, 4, 5, was it, Yagis coupled on it, so as to make it movable. So that we were looking to check on the well-known meteor rates at that time.
I see. So you probably would eventually have gotten it.
Oh, we'd have eventually got it, but I'm just throwing in that.
Right. So which meteor shower was this then?
Well, that was the first of the daytime streams, which we Johnny Clegg positioned out where they radiance. And actually, there's another story that Douglas Forsyth, I think it was Douglas Forsyth, the Scotsman who went. he since they came from Piskies. As one pronounced it there, he christened them the Piskies. And Lovell refused to accept this name because he thought it was vulgar.
Right.
And it wasn't until the reporter came to ask how the meteor streams were going on, Lovell said, turned to Forsyth and said, how are the summer streams coming along? And he said, oh, the Piskies rate has increased or gone down. It was only then that it was accepted as a term. But the actual meteor streams were all, really, they were so... it finally came down to really there only being, I think, three well-defined streams. What essentially one had done was to find a whole random series of meteors coming in random directions. And so, in fact, it's one of these problems with statistics that you look at things, you recognize patterns which don't really exist. So the daytime streams were essentially more or less a kind of random distribution.
And only three of them that really...
And I think it came down essentially to about three. Two papers, I think it took 2 years after that before it came to determine the individual meteors.
Now, the famous Jacobinides stream, that was just before you arrived,
that
I guess.
That was the Jacobinides, that's right, that's the one that we more or less went through the Jacobinides comet, and that was where the rate went up, and that was the confirmation.
Right.
That would have been, I think,
it
in between
46,
my... 46, that would be between my visit there in the summer and my arriving there in December.
So you weren't involved in that
business? No.
Do you know where Clegg is now?
Last time I heard of him, he was at Imperial College still.
Oh, I see. Oh, that's right. I do have his address. I take that back.
He didn't get on with Lovell. You don't want to really discuss that, do you?
Well, I mean, is it relevant to how things developed in the group? I mean, is that why he left the group?
That was why essentially he left the group.
When did he leave? Of course, they wrote that early book together.
Oh, yeah, well, there's another story about that as well, actually. these are the social aspects, and the old stories of old General Bang. I don't know whether you...
but when did Clegg leave?
Clegg left, it must have been about 48, 49.
Oh, I see, even before you did.
I think it was about the time... Well, let's see, maybe about 49, because Lovell, he and Lovell didn't get on well together, and Lovell complained bitterly to Blackett about him. He said he smoked too much and he drank too much and he didn't want him around, so Blackett took him off on his rock magnetism. and then Clegg moved with Blackett down to Imperial College.
I see.
And the time I saw Clegg many years ago, I was walking along Prince Consort Road. Incidentally, this is going to be edited, isn't it?
Well, you will get a transcript of, or I should say a draft of the book, and anything I put in there relevant to your interview. But, I mean, this sort of thing I'm not going to be putting in the book. I mean...
Okay, well,
But, okay, so you left Jodrell in 49. Is there anything else we should talk about your early Jodrell, your 2 years that you were there?
I think that's...
I think we've covered it pretty well.
I think so, yes.
And then you went with Hayes Group, which was at what institution now?
That was the Army Operational Research Group in West Byfleet, Surrey. It was the, if you like, kind of experimental laboratories of the War Office. So that in those days, various experiments were carried out, such as, I remember one time we had a tank there, and infrared people were interested in trying to detect the temperature mm-hmm. of the tank.
Right.
And as a matter of interest, I said also that you should be able to detect it at radio waves. And sure enough, I wrote a report up on some uh-huh. measurements on the detection of tanks using natural centimetric sure. radiation. But there were various other experiments, the physiology. They designed packs, actually. I remember the physiologist designing packs, army packs, by mm-hmm. using tremor, measuring the electrical impulses on the end of nerves to get some idea of how much a muscle was used.
And using it. Was this the army equivalent of TRE?
No, it was something completely different. TRE actually went into the design of radar equipment and airborne equipment mainly, though some army and some navy. Army Operational Research Group was essentially operational research. This was finding out, essentially getting reports on the performance of various devices in the field or assessing what their performance
right.
might be in the future.
And improving them, yeah.
That's right. One had to, you know, the sort of thing one had was, one can say it now, but I was always intrigued that one used to get reports from military intelligence of Russian radar equipment.
Mm-hmm.
And it's quite interesting, once a week or once a month, the reports used to come around. Interesting to see
right.
how one could build up the whole picture of the radar performance of these mm-hmm. things. From
just monitoring their...
Monitoring the frequency and the
radar... The frequency and the rate gives you the beam, gives you the size of the dish,
that's right, that's
and so
right.
forth.
That's right. Then someone's seen a radar on top of a building and that's come through something.
Right.
Yeah, all these... so we provided advice on this as well.
What was your motivation to go there? What were you going to work on?
I was going to continue in radio astronomy because Hay wanted to build up a group again in radio astronomy, but at the same time one realized one had to do work on some other things in order to justify being
right.
being paid, essentially. It's the same old story that it is
just
now.
Just like the Naval Research Lab or something places, yeah.
Yeah, but I mean it's the same old story that in those days no one knew what radio astronomy was, let alone what a radio astronomer was.
Right.
And so there weren't really any jobs, you had something else. It's the same thing these days,
yeah.
that no jobs for radio.
Right, we get paid for teaching you, not for doing radio astronomy.
That's
really.
Right. We went through the good old days when you could get paid for it, but not now.
So
we mixed up a number of these things.
Hey, Phillips and Parsons had left by then, I think.
They had left. They had
restarted.
The other person who was there was Stewart.
He was still there.
He was still there. And as far as I know, he's still there now, actually. But I wouldn't have said that he was a kind of particularly... active and vigorous sort of person,
mm-hmm.
And in fact, from moving from Jodrell Bank to a civil service organization was a little bit tedious, so one get frustrations and various other things coming
mm-hmm.
up. But that was essentially the work, mixture of radar, one started working on doing on things such as what were the limitations in a radar system due to the atmosphere? These were things that weren't quite well known.
But now,
but then that only lasted for 2 years, I think, until I think it was about February of 1952 that I moved to Malvern.
I see. And now, why did that move come about?
That move came about because Hay had become director of the Army Operational Research Group. The other people had left, the university people had left, and
mm-hmm.
he'd risen up and he'd become director. And I don't think he was director material for one thing, and anyway, in the reorganization they decided to bring someone else in. They did say to Hay that he could do whatever he wanted to do, sort of thing, but
mm-hmm.
They brought this other person in. Essentially it was a reorganization of the Army Operational Research Group, depending more on computers to assess the ability of one side to win a battle than anything else.
Mm-hmm.
Everything was kind of becoming out to the computer wars with computers. So Hay was then a little bit unhappy in some ways, but he was approached and asked if he'd like to start a special research group at the Radar Research and Development Establishment in Malvern. That was separate from Telecommunication Research Establishment, or TRE as it was, in that it dealt with the Army radar. And the idea was to give it a little bit of a fillip by bringing some new research work in. And it was thought that radio research and radio astronomy and this sort of thing would be a useful sort of work.
Now, was TRE also at Malvern?
TRE was also at Malvern, and it had its physics department with R.A. Smith as head. And but they were working on more, they were more solid state physics.
I see.
And there was no real research in radio, as it was called. So we went to Malvern and we formed the group. Oh, we took over the Pulse Light as well. And well, I guess the story there would be more of a social side, that the Pulse Light experiment, I just kind of looked in on at times, and I can always remember one of the troubles there, measuring the variation density of the upper atmosphere by sending out a pulse and measuring the time of return. But there was using an arc, and the real trouble was that after that arc, there was a long decay of fluorescence coming mm-hmm. from somewhere. It was the glass which was fluorescing.
I see.
And one often thinks back that one only realized what it was, one might have in fact come down to inventing a laser, because essentially this was one of the forbidden transitions in glass, and in fact there are some glass lasers, they're not quite as good as the others.
Right.
But this is the sort of thing that one, in that sort of work is
after the fact you begin thinking
after
about
the fact,
this, yeah.
That's right.
But now, what did you and Hay think that you would do in radio or radar astronomy? What was your...
Well, the first thing, I was doing two things at the time. One, I was starting to monitor the sun at 10 centimeters. And the other was that we built up a low-frequency array at about 22 megahertz and an interferometer. And we made the mistake of building it up with full-wave dipoles, which were very difficult to calibrate and assess the effective impedance of proximity to the Earth, etc. So that though we did Major Cygnus and Cassiopeia, was in fact we got the intensities. There was an error in the flux density measurements that we obtained, and it was useful in some ways, and it stimulated Lovell to try and shoot us down as rapidly as he could. Because in fact, I mean, I think this was maintaining radio astronomy for John Will Banks. Mm-hmm.
So that was his paper in Nature in 1954.
That was a paper in Nature, that's right.
22 megahertz.
Right. And incidentally, after the noise from Jupiter had been discovered, when I went back to those records, there was the noise, but we couldn't have detected it at the time because it was too close to Cygnus and Cassiopeia.
You would never have been able to distinguish it.
We could see that there was noise there, but one would never have been able to distinguish it at that time because it was too close to Cygnus and Cassiopeia. They produced large side lobes. If we waited another 6 months... With that instrument, we waited another few months, we might have detected it. But this was the sort of thing that...
You never published that, I don't think.
No.
Of course, Shane
no.
went back to his records.
That's right.
And, but did you establish that such that when Jupiter was not in the beam, you never saw any of this noise also?
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. But you see, there was an interferometer, Cygnus and Cassiopeia.
Sure. Yeah, no, I know what you mean. You get these side lobes.
That's right. You could see noise coming up on other occasions, which was obviously Jupiter, but it wasn't. I'm just saying that's the sort of thing.
No, that's interesting. Yeah.
Well, then, actually, following that, we then moved to... The radar research and development establishment and the telecommunications research establishment amalgamated and became the Royal Radar Establishment, or I think it was the Radio Research Establishment in the...
RRE, anyway.
The RRE, right. And we became part of the physics department. That led to some troubles because a friend of mine, Owen Story, who was the original Whistler man, he's now in Paris, he was over at RRE with R.A. Smith,
mm-hmm.
and he wanted to come and join us.
In radio astronomy.
In radio astronomy, but R.A. Smith said, well, I wouldn't bother doing that if I were you, because radio astronomy isn't going to last much longer. Anyway, we survived. I think this may have been one of the other troubles that Hay had to put up with as well.
So there was another paper you haven't talked about where you did an analysis of... 4 meter in the late 40s, 5 years worth of data and
okay.
so forth.
That essentially, most of that was came about at the Army Operational Research Group when I moved there, and Hay had got a lot of this data, and essentially was massaging it, as we call it now,
right,
or an
right.
analyze.
But
I joined in with him on the massaging.
Where did the data come from, though?
The data came, I'm pretty sure, now then, where did that data come from? I think it was some data that was obtained after the war, when in fact the radar sets, the Army radar had nothing much to do, so Hay persuaded them to monitor radiation.
I can check the paper, of course, but
right. I think that might have been mm-hmm. it, or that was the excuse for looking at meteors, radar echoes from meteors. I'm not quite sure.
Okay, well, I'll check the paper. But in the abstract, it says you had this curious effect that there were more flares east of the center meridian than the west, and you...
Oh.
I've never heard of that one before. What is the story
on
that?
Oh, yeah, that's going back too long to remember that. Dublin, I gave that paper. I went over to Dublin, the Solar Terrestrial Relationship meeting, to present that paper. I've forgotten now what... We found this queer... It was something, it was this queer effect that cropped up. It came out of the analysis of the data. I'd have to think about that and go back to actually tell you I haven't thought about that before.
Well, let's go back now to the low frequency interferometer you had, where you got burnt more or less on the Cygnus A and Cass A. Mm-hmm. I don't think there's any more work from that. Did that persuade you to give up on?
Well, we gave up on that because of the amalgamation of the
two groups. And so, what was the next?
The next thrust there was that we looked around for a radio telescope, and there was a German Würzburg antenna at the Radio Research and Development Establishment, and I think we put this in. I think we put this in motion before the amalgamation. It was, I don't know if you remember, it was part of a radar equipment which was on a train. The Germans had it, and they used to...
Yes, I know about that.
They towed it across. Well, we had the telescope, the radio telescope, and essentially what we did was to have a 45-foot diameter telescope made, have it mounted on the Würzburg mount, and the Würzburg mount put on top of a tower, so that we had a 45-foot diameter radio telescope. Now, I planned at that time to do some 10-centimeter observations, to take some 10-centimeter observations, and